I am back with Rory Stewart. Rory, thanks for doing this.
Hello, Sam. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, so this is an unusual podcast. I haven't done one quite like this before, but and obviously we this will not see the light of day unless each of us believes the conversation is useful. So if you're hearing this, that's what we thought, for better or worse. So I'll just kind of set this up and to remind both of us and our listeners what's happening here. So you came on my podcast a few weeks ago, and I thought we had a great conversation. We discussed many things related to the failures of nation building, about which you know more or less everything, and the unraveling of world order. And then afterwards, a listener surfaced some remarks that you made on your own podcast, which I'll drop in here for listeners about, you know, 60 seconds or so.
One of the things that I've noticed recently, particularly since October the 7th, is an increase in people making stereotypical comments about Muslims. I mean, I just did an interview with an American podcast, a guy called Sam Harris, who was hammering me for nearly an hour saying, yes, but surely, Rory, you have to admit there's a connection between Muslims and suicide bombers and Muslims and terrorists. He just wouldn't let it go. And I wondered, is that something that you've experienced? And is it something that's getting better, getting worse? How does our society deal with it?
I think it's getting worse. Well, maybe it comes in cycles. But I remember, for me, 9/11 was such a seminal moment for me. And that might sound a bit kind of selfish, given, you know, thousands of miles away and affected and killed so many thousands of Americans. But for me, it was a day I'll always remember. I mean, 9/11 took place on a Tuesday, I think, and coming back from school and school bus home, you know, radio was on, you can kind of hear what was going on, and the driver was telling us to shut up because he was trying to listen to what was going on. You know, went home and saw all the scenes, as you guys would have seen, in the terrible, tragic and terror attack that took place. And then the next day, I remember going to school and sitting in form class, and, you know, the same two guys I used to sit beside every single morning, and we'd talk about the things that teenage boys talk about, mainly in my case, Celtic, you know, football club I loved. And they were bombarding me, not with any maliciousness, just bombarding me with questions that I had no idea the answer to. You know, why do Muslims hate America? Do you know who was behind it? What was it all about? I'm sitting there going, I don't have a clue, right? And so for me, and then of course, all the Islamophobia that followed post 9/11. But I have to say, my position as First Minister, and even perhaps before then, there is definitely still a deep-rooted, systemic and endemic Islamophobia in this country. And Scotland is absolutely not immune to that.
You were speaking with Humza Yousaf, who's a Scottish politician who happens to be Muslim. And I would invite people to listen to our previous conversation to form their own impression of it. But as I told you by email, I was quite surprised that you came away feeling that I had hounded you for an hour on the connection between Islam and terrorism. I think we spoke about jihadism for about 20 minutes in the context of a nearly 90-minute conversation. So anyway, people can listen to it and form their own impression. But leaving that aside, you know, I was surprised that you seemed to form the opinion that I was bigoted against Muslims as people. I mean, there's really no way for me to understand what you were saying to Humza that doesn't entail my being a regrettable example of what he called Islamophobia. So I just wanted to discuss this, not principally to defend myself, but to clarify the underlying issues, because I think the worst implication of what you were saying has nothing to do with me or with your impression of me. From my point of view, the worst implication is that you think or seem to think that any special focus on Islam as a system of ideas and any special concern about how these ideas produce violence and intolerance is in itself a sign of bigotry, right? And that's something I'd like to talk about and see if there's anything we disagree about on these fundamental issues, completely independent of what you thought about our last conversation or what you or anyone else thinks about me. So anyway, that's how I propose to start. So, you know, feel free to chime in and then we'll get rolling.
Sure, Sam. Well, I mean, let me begin by apologizing and apologizing, I think, for three things. I think the first fundamental thing is whatever I felt about our conversation, it was not appropriate for me to express my discomfort in that way in public. And I heard in your voice and in your response and your emails that it will have felt very hurtful to you. And so I think I began by realizing that that was a very wrong thing to do, and I shouldn't have done that. And I can absolutely understand why hearing that cold to you would have seemed very bewildering and shocking. I think the second thing is, you're absolutely right. I remembered it as being a very long conversation. And I think one of the reasons for it is that I, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about this. I mean, it'd be nice to give your listeners something that maybe they don't get, which is the context of recording podcasts and what a very eccentric environment a podcast is, because they listen to these kind of smooth voices down there, down the airs, and they have no real idea of what's going on. So my day that day, it's excuse, but it's a partial explanation. I'd had a long day. It was late in the evening. For some reason, you, I think, like many other people recording high quality podcasts, like to do it in studios. And studios always seem to be a very long way away from wherever you are. So you slog out to a studio, you get there, you sit in a pretty hot room. And I was hoping very much to get on to talk about international development, which was really the thing. And I noticed that I think 55 minutes in, I was still in this conversation, which you're quite right, we had not begun with. The first half hours had been spent getting there through other things. So it was unfair of me to say that we'd spent almost an hour on this. And you're absolutely right, we'd spent about 20 minutes on this. And then I guess the third thing that I need to apologize to you for is that I don't think in any way you have some animus against Muslims. What I was uncomfortable about is slightly more complicated thing to explain, and maybe we can get into that. But I wanted to begin with the apologies. You're absolutely right to be shocked. You're right that I was exaggerating when I said that we talked about this for almost an hour. And you're right to be upset at the suggestion that I think that you are somehow prejudiced against Muslims.
Well, yeah, so I appreciate the apology, and that's a good example of a good one, just apologizing in such a straightforward way. But just to be clear, my reaction wasn't so much of being personally offended. I mean, because the truth is, I know I'm not a bigot, and I know that this terrain is pretty confusing, right? I know that it's very easy, and in fact, I'm going to argue, when we touch the concept of Islamophobia, I'm going to argue that this landscape has been engineered to be confusing by apologists for Islam. I mean, there's a conscious effort to obfuscate criticism of ideas with animus toward people, brown-skinned people coming from other countries, say. And that's just, I just know that's not true of me, and I'm surprised that you could seem to imagine that it might be, but I'm much more...
Can I summon on that? I don't think that's really what I thought. I think it felt to me as though you were very uncomfortable with Islam. I don't think I thought that you were...
But I am.
So I think, as with all these things, there's an element of misunderstanding, and there's probably an element of some disagreement which is hidden under politeness. And I think the other reason that I probably was obsessing about it in that way and talking about it in that way on my podcast is that I'd felt uncomfortable with myself. I felt I hadn't done a good enough job standing up for Islam. I hadn't done a good enough job standing up for my experience of living in the Islamic world. And I felt that I had become a sort of apologist, that I found it very tiring. And I felt that I was in this position of perpetually saying, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of, you know, very bad jihadis, but then there are other people that are bad. And I'd give another historical example. And then we'd loop back again. And maybe what I wanted to say is, listen, this just doesn't sit with my experience of having spent many years of my life living in Muslim majority countries. It just doesn't sit with my experience of Muslim friends. And I should have been braver and less apologetic in talking to you.
Oh, great. Well, so yeah, let's just get into the issues here, because again, this is genuinely confusing. And I think it's really interesting, because I think you're a perfect person for me to be talking to about this, because I think we probably disagree. And we disagree for reasons that will be a little hard for people to weight appropriately. I mean, for instance, I'll just stipulate that you have much, much more experience than I do of being, much less living, to say nothing of living in Muslim majority countries, which I have never done. Right? I've traveled to some degree in them, but so you have. I can only imagine you have scores of, if not hundreds of, Muslim friends. And, you know, that I can't say that of myself. And so there's a wealth of experience, everything from your speaking various native languages to your having spent time living in the homes of Muslims. I mean, just there's just no comparison, right? You're T.E. Lawrence, you know, compared to me. And yet I still would argue that there are certain things here that you're very likely wrong about. And so it's worth, you know, threading this needle.
And can I also say something? Sorry, I'm going to be mean here.
Please.
I'm very, very happy to do this. And let's do some of this. But I'd also love to move on to some other subjects. There's some, I'd love to talk to you about your life, about your meditation, about other things. I think one of the things that I worry about, just as a kind of preface to this, is that neither you nor I are Muslims. And although we've both read the Quran, I don't think either of us are deep Arabic scholars. So I think that maybe... Yeah. There may be other things that we could also talk about as well as this.
Well, yeah, if we have time, but I do think there's going to be enough here to fill this session. I can only imagine, but I'm happy to talk about anything, obviously. And I think we should talk about this very claim as though the truth of Islam that I'm worried about, as well as the, you know, the other happier truths about it that you are more in touch with, that require the kind of expertise that you just claimed neither of us have to find. I mean, I think that's untrue. I mean, I think, and, you know, we'll get there. But let me just make two claims, which I think could sharpen up our whatever disagreement we're going to discover here, and just to have you react to them, because I think this will be a good lens through which to look at it. The first claim I'd like to make is that it's perfectly possible, and I would say necessary, to speak about the ideological roots of Islamism and jihadism, and even about the unique need for reform within mainstream Islam itself, without lapsing into bigotry against Muslims as people, right? And without disregarding the suffering of refugees or failing to criticize the indiscretions of Western foreign policy or Israeli leadership or anything else that might be worth criticizing. We can do all of that without being bigots. And as I began to say when we started, the concept of Islamophobia has been designed to obfuscate this. You know, someone once said on the internet that Islamophobia is a word invented by fascists and used by cowards to manipulate morons. And I honestly think that's not far from the truth. I mean,
I think if you set it up in that way, you're setting it up in a difficult light.
Well, I
think that phrase is a pretty unfortunate phrase. Who produced that phrase?
I don't know.
I'm suspicious of that individual.
It's often attributed to Christopher Hitchens, but it was not him. But it has a very Hitch-like concision, and barb. But my point is that there's no question that the term is confusing people, and I think that's intentional. But leave the intention aside. Its function, in my experience, is to conflate any criticism of Islam, which is a doctrine of religious beliefs, with bigotry against Muslims as people. And in fact, it often equates...
And Sam, can I just come in on this? I can see the distinction, but is it not possible that those two things are more closely connected than in practice than you want to acknowledge? I mean, if you concluded that Islam was a uniquely unpleasant or violent or dangerous religion, and you went around emphasizing that, does that not cast some light on Muslims?
Well, let me show you how it doesn't, right? So, or in my case, so obviously bigotry is a real thing out in this world. There are real bigots, there are racists, there are xenophobes, there are people who don't like Arabs. Obviously, I'd be insane to doubt any of that, and many of those people live in my own country, right? So there are, you know, white supremacist, racist assholes who don't want any more immigrants, who don't look like them or talk like them or eat the same foods, right? So
that's a bit different. I think the Islamophobia is making a different kind of claim, isn't it? It's not really. I mean, you're talking there about some form of racism, aren't you?
I think Islamophobia, in my experience, is often used as a kind of synonym for racism. I mean,
maybe in the US debate. I think in the UK debate, what we tend to mean is that it's very difficult to suggest that something that somebody believes
is inherently wrong, evil, violent, and not end up casting some moral aspersion on the individual that holds that belief. You know, for example, if you, it would be difficult. Let's say I can't quite imagine, for example, saying, I think that Nazism is an unbelievably evil ideology, but I'm not prejudiced against Nazis. I'm not prejudiced against people who hold that belief. I mean, Islamophobia, presumably by its definition, is a fear of Islam. It's not a phobia towards Islam, not towards a particular group of people. I mean, it's something that could be applied to a white Muslim.
Okay.
Could be applied to a Bosnian. Could be. So
exactly.
My understanding of it is it's having a phobia towards Islam as a religion and what that constitutes in terms of the attitude you take to believers in that religion. So that's why I'm using this analogy, that if I thought that Islam was an inherently evil religion akin to my view on Nazi belief, I would have a very profound negative moral judgment of anybody who believed in it. I wouldn't be able to separate a claim that the religion was uniquely sinister and evil with being able to suggest that I had a warm relationship towards people who held views that I found that profoundly reprehensible.
Well, except, I mean, realistically, there's a continuum of belief within the set of all Muslims, right? And you're talking about 2 billion people or maybe 2.2 billion people now. And there's just a wide range of commitments, and some are, and then to say nothing of ex-Muslims, right? People who were born Muslim, raised Muslim, and then left the faith and have all the ethnic and racial characteristics that they had before they left the faith, right? So there's no, I mean, that's a very clear way of seeing that.
But we're talking here of believers. We're talking here of people who are Muslims, not people who were born Muslim.
Right.
I mean,
my
grandfather was Jewish, but I wouldn't self-identify as being Jewish because I don't participate in those rituals. I don't have those beliefs.
Okay. Well, so let me just say that your associations with the term Islamophobia, certainly from an American perspective, are highly non-standard. I mean, the way Islamophobia is used in an American context and by an organization like CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations, is very much a conflation with racism and xenophobia, right? So that it's all about castigating people as racists and bigots whenever they criticize Islam as a set of ideas, right? Now, to move to your point of, okay, let's purify our conception of the term. It obviously just relates to a religion and a set of religious beliefs and those who adhere to it to whatever degree. How can you criticize these beliefs as energetically as I do without actually being bigoted against the people, right? Or, because if you really think these beliefs are dangerous.
And let me take it to its extreme. I mean, you kind of get my point, I guess, about Nazis, that you couldn't imagine a situation in which we agree that that's a uniquely evil ideology. And therefore, you couldn't really imagine saying, I think Nazism is uniquely evil ideology, but I have nothing against Nazis themselves.
Except, right, there, if you look at, you really have to do a little work to make the analogy run through. If you imagine people who have been brainwashed from the moment they could understand language into Nazism, right? So they were Nazis as kids, and now I'm talking to the 18-year-old version of themselves. I have a fair amount of compassion for anyone who, it's analogous to, what's happening in North Korea, right? Like the North Koreans are painfully immured in a cult wherein they just don't have adequate information, right? They have been effectively brainwashed. I mean, they're, 4 inches shorter than their South Korean brothers and sisters, and they think they're a master race. I mean, it's an insane psychological experiment that they're party to, right? So they believe a wide range of odious things, one can only imagine. And yet, I don't really hold them responsible for it. And I view many, many Muslims, and I would view many, many Nazis in the analogous situation along those lines. I mean, it's just that people have had bad ideas drummed into them from the moment they could think, and now we're in this position of talking to them and hoping to persuade them of better ideas.
So I guess one issue which is maybe central to this is the question of whether there is an Islam or whether there are what I tend to believe, which is many different Islams. So I don't see a religion as a unitary thing which you or I can securely define, or where you and I get to regulate who is or is not a true Muslim. In fact, the people who do that, of course, you know, both you and I would be troubled by for different reasons. We would both be troubled for the same reasons, but by people who went around saying, you're not a real Muslim. My sense of religion is that it's much more of a complex set of social, cultural practices and values, and it's much better understood through participating in those societies and observing the way in which people relate to each other in the world. And looked at from that point of view, I agree with you. There are people who identify as Muslims and who have a form of Islam which is ignorant, cruel, bigoted, and monstrous, of which ISIS and Al-Qaeda and many of the Hamas leadership have different versions of that. But equally, there are the people that I want to speak up for, which are the, you know, I grew up partially in Malaysia, I lived in Indonesia, I lived in Bosnia, I lived in Afghanistan, I lived in Iraq, and I was surrounded by people who were devout practicing Muslims praying five times a day, who were amongst the most generous, kindest, most compassionate, thoughtful, honorable people I've ever lived among. And I think the point is that there may be something wrong in trying to say there is this thing called Islam and these are real Muslims and these people aren't, rather than accepting that there are multiple types of Muslim.
Well, I accept that, and yet that claim doesn't really do the work I think you wanted to do here, right? So I mean, let me just make my second claim that I wanted to make at the outset just to frame the conversation, because I think it will land us in the territory where our differences are obvious. I mean, so the first claim was that you can criticize Islam without being bigoted against Muslims as people, and you seem to accept that quite happily because your construal of what Islamophobia means really does relate to the ideas and not to superficial characteristics like people's skin color and culture and et cetera. Which is fine, again, but that, you know, when you come to America, I'll show you around. The second claim is that while every religion has its fanatics, right, and there are fanatics among Jews and Hindus and every other religion, as you know, there's only one religion on earth that now routinely seeks to impose its religious taboos on everyone else with threats of violence, right? I mean, there's only one religion that has made it unsafe routinely. Again, you can find corner conditions where other religions have done this, but generally speaking, there's only one religion that has made it unsafe for people to criticize it, or indeed for its own members to leave it, right? And in my experience only, and I really have lived on the front lines of this for now 20 years as a fairly famous atheist. In my experience, only Muslims routinely fear for their lives when they decide to leave their religion, right? And this is true even in the West. And if you doubt this, you for all the Muslims you have spent time with, you need to spend some more time with ex-Muslims, even in your own society, even in the UK, because this is absolutely routine to have a rational right. fear that you will be murdered by your own community.
So, Sam, let me come back to this, because I think, again, this is a question of us agreeing on a lot, but not entirely. And again, I'd return to this idea that there are many different Islams. I don't accept it as a general description of the religion, that the religion as a whole is a religion which is inherently imposing itself on other people and trying to murder apostates and this, that, and the other. I mean, I lived in Indonesia, and Indonesia is the largest Muslim majority country in the world. And that is not a reasonable description of the way in which Islam operates in that country, or indeed in Malaysia. So it seems to me—
You can be an apostate in Malaysia and Indonesia? That is, you're a former Muslim, you now disavow the faith, and now you start having your apostasy podcast, and you'll be safe in one of those societies?
So this is where I come back to the many different Islams. Within those societies, there will be Muslims with very extreme violent views on apostasy. And in Afghanistan, for example, there was overwhelming support for a suggestion that the government was going to kill an apostate, right? That was a society with these sorts of views. So I'm not denying that those societies exist, or that there are many Muslims, including Muslims I know and who were friends with in Afghanistan, who had these terrifying views on things like apostasy. I absolutely accept that. Equally, I've just been living in Jordan for the last year and a half, and I am pretty confident that most of my Jordanian Muslim friends would not in any way support the notion of executing people for apostasy. So I think this questions of degree. I mean, you may be right that there are more that Islam may be in a more vigorous state than Christianity or Judaism. You may also be right that the proportion of people within the religion with more extreme and violent views may be slightly higher. What I'm holding against is an idea that there is this thing called Islam where the fact that an Islamist or a jihadist can read a particular set of lines in a text means that every Muslim necessarily must hold those same beliefs.
Well, no. I mean, this really is a red herring, Rory. It's not, obviously, there are many, many millions of Muslims who don't even read the Quran or the Hadith, or having read them, don't take them much more seriously than a Reformed Jew or a very progressive Christian takes their holy books. I would argue there's much less of that kind of liberalism and secularism in the Muslim world and in Muslim communities in the West, but there's still some of it, certainly. And in addition to that, there are many people who just want to get along in the modern world, and wherever their religion makes that difficult, they let their religion slide, right? And that's true of every faith, right? And so there's every variant of this. But what there isn't is there's two claims I would make here that sharpen up the difference between Islam and every other faith at this moment that I think it's important to acknowledge. One is, as I just said, there really is no other faith where it is routine for its members to worry about what's going to happen to them if they leave it. And I mean,
okay,
not just...
Okay, well, let me come in on that.
Well, Rory, you keep interrupting me, and I can't... Rory, you just got to let me land the point. I'm going to give you more to react to. Rory, you keep derailing me before I give you...
But often there are three or four different claims. Let me write it down there. Okay. I'll write down that first claim that there's no religion that responds in that way to apostasy. Okay. On you go.
Yeah. And again, you need only spend time with ex-Muslims to know how poorly advertised this experience is, but how widespread it is. And I would additionally argue it's not an accident, given the explicit anathema around apostasy in Islam, that really is not nearly as clear in other faiths, right? And some faiths don't have it at all. But the other point here is that, which just reveals the difference, is that like, if you look at something like the Islamic State, I think you and I both agree that the Islamic State is the purest example of jihadist horror to emerge in our lifetime. If you look at what they were doing in all its details, taking sex Yazidis as sex slaves and decapitating, apostates and, cutting the hands off of thieves, killing fornicators, adulterers, etc., all of it, every permutation of the horror, you look at all of those specifics, and if you didn't know what religion was underlying all of this, and you just had to play, multiple choice with the religions on offer, and someone came in and said, well, yeah, these people are clearly Buddhists. I mean, they're the most extreme Buddhists on earth. That would make absolutely no sense if you actually look at the principles of Buddhism. If you read the Pali Canon or any other set of Buddhist texts, you're not going to get anything that looks like the Islamic State. You're going to get some bizarre things, I'll grant you. And it is in fact true that you get just generic religious tribalism across many faiths. But there's only one faith where if you look at the letter of the law, the letter makes absolute sense of what we were seeing in Syria and Iraq under the Islamic State. And when you look at somebody like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, as much as you want to say against him as a person and as a leader, it is very difficult to argue that he is getting the religion wrong, that he's completely distorting the faith. And that's a problem. This is not at all synonymous as saying that most Muslims would agree with him, but you can't look at him and what he was doing and advocating be done and insisting was real and true and the only thing that was actually observant of the faith. You can't look at him and say, okay, well, he's getting all of these things so obviously wrong, because he just wasn't. It's all there in the Quran and the Hadith and the biography of Muhammad. And that's a problem. That's a problem for the Muslim world, and it's a problem for the whole world, because in my experience, moderate Muslims and secular Muslims and Muslims who want nothing to do with that kind of mayhem and obvious evil are not very good and not very willing to honestly talk about the problem, the actual ideological roots of jihadism and the need to disavow and truly modernize specific doctrines around blasphemy and apostasy and jihad and martyrdom, etc. Right? So there's a lack of candor within the Muslim world and among liberals who don't want Muslims judged because they view them as beleaguered minorities within their own societies. There's a lack of candor here, and Islamophobia is used as an insult so as to block conversation on this topic. And finally, I would just say that I think it's quite ironic and really typical of the nature of the problem as I see it, that, you know, we're having this conversation, and you were on your own podcast talking the way you were the very week when one of your colleagues in Parliament, or your former colleague, Mike Freer, announced that he was leaving public office because he found the threats to his life from Islamists so intolerable, right? So it's not that I'm making up this problem of Islamism in the West. It's an excruciating problem. And I'm simply advocating that we and moderate Muslims above all need to talk honestly about it. And to pretend that this is a problem that is shared equally by all religions at this moment is just pure obfuscation, in my view.
Well, Sam, I think the problem with doing this is you've made 7 different claims in a single paragraph.
I disagree with
a lot of them.
Go for it.
Okay. So I think your first claim that this is the only religion that's ever existed that has extreme punishments.
Not that's ever existed. I'm only religion currently. If you give me the Christians of the 14th century, I will agree that they're dangerous imbeciles. Yes.
Well, I mean, but that's worth taking seriously, right? I mean, it's worth understanding how fundamental it was to the Spanish Inquisition that the notion of apostasy was punished with death, that heretics were burned, not just in the 14th century. Heretics continued to be burned right the way through to the 17th century.
Yeah.
That people, and this was entirely integrated into an entire Christian theological structure. So that's my first thing. This notion that there is something unique to Islam. Now, it may be that in its current form, at this particular snapshot in time, there are far more emphasis in the Islamic world on the subject of apostasy and far more use of textual justification than there is in the Christian world. But that seems to me not to be a logical necessity. That seems to be a historical observation.
Well, so I'll just please keep going, but I will plant a flag there of disagreement, or at least I need to give you a caveat.
Let's take one at a time, or we're going to keep...
Okay, let's take one at a time. Yeah, great. Yeah. So the only... I fully agree, and I wrote... You may or may know this or not, but my second book was titled Letter to a Christian Nation, where it's really just a broadside against Christianity of an American style, where I review a lot of this. And I would say simply that there are some differences, logical differences, you know, theological differences that matter between Christianity and Islam, which make what we saw in the 14th century among Christians more anomalous than... I understand your laughter, but just let me simply land the point, because I think it's true. You know, and I'm not at all an apologist for a fundamentalist Christianity or Christianity at all, but it's more anomalous when you see all of the bloodletting in defense of the faith that happened under Christendom. The reason why that's more anomalous than the analogous barbarity under Islam is simply when you look at what most people most of the time construe as the central message of Jesus and the example of how he lived, right? And Jesus was not a conquering warlord who had people decapitated, right? He was basically a hippie who got crucified, you know. And there's no Sermon on the Mount in the Quran, right? There's no similar advocate. You can't get pacifism out of the doctrine in the same way that you could get pacifism if you wanted to out of Christianity. And I would just say the Bible is a much longer more contradictory, self-contradictory book, and you can get more or less anything you want out of it. And yes, Aquinas and Augustine and their students under the, you know, Catholicism did get a fairly stark intolerance for heresy, which lit the fires of the Inquisition. Absolutely. And it's and I'm no fan. So, you know, I just wanted to give you the caveat that there are, it's not just a historically contingent claim. There are theological differences.
There are obviously differences between Christianity and Islam. And I think you're accurate in some of those differences. But I don't think those differences are that important. I think the fundamental truth
They weren't in the 14th century.
No, exactly. The fundamental, judge people by their behavior and their actions. And the fact is that this religion, whatever was there, was perfectly consistent with crusades, with inquisitions, with burning heretics and all this kind of stuff.
Well, These were deeply
religious people who spent a lot of time praying, a lot of time reading the Bible, a lot of time thinking about
just
theology.
Not so much the Sermon on the Mount.
And ditto, I would argue that ISIS...
That's the problem. The problem is if you read the Quran, you so readily get the Islamic State. If you look at the example of Muhammad, you so readily get the Islamic State. That's a problem.
That's your fourth claim that I need to get onto.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think it's odd that you think that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has a better ijtihad. He has a better interpretation of the Quran than the main body of Islamic scholarship from the 7th century until about 1950 or 1980. I think Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is fundamentally a product of the modern world, and I think a lot of his interpretations of the Quran and his insistence and the insistence of a lot of other jihadis, that theirs is closer to the spirit of the text, is wrong. I think actually in many ways, these people are profoundly bizarre and ignorant, and they're often taking a lot of the texts that they're quoting. Well, you know, the text, if they've transgressed, is basically just the same as the Old Testament comment about an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And on the basis of this very fragile foundation, they build the most extraordinary justifications for atrocities which in other parts of the Quran appear to be forbidden.
Well, I mean, there's this whole principle of abrogation, as you must know, where certain verses of the Quran are widely thought to abrogate the meaning of earlier verses that they seem to contradict, and the later verses are
because
are
all
thought
these
to
texts are contradictory, aren't they? I mean, well, and you know, yeah, if, but you not, go not, Bible, if we go back to the Bible, if we go back to the Bible, I mean, the genealogies of Jesus and the Gospels are flatly contradictory.
Yeah, yeah,
we're told
of
completely different things about, you know, very basic facts about his life, and it's true that obviously the Quran has a different status because it's dictated directly by God, but it's still something that requires enormous thoughtfulness. And these guys are behaving, I think, you know, Osama bin Laden, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and the whole Ikhwani movement are basically behaving like the most bizarre, ignorant fundamentalists. They're often deliberately ignorant of Islamic scholarship, deliberately ignorant of the very, very careful interpretations of those verses made over many centuries by very thoughtful scholars.
I'm going to support and wish for and hope for very, very careful interpretation of all of those passages going forward so as to make Islam as benign as you seem to think it can be. That's a wonderful thing.
I don't see what the phrase is, Sam. Because, I mean, remember, I'm saying there are many different Islams. I'm not trying to deny that the type of Islam perpetrated by ISIS is anything other than everything that you say. I'm just trying to resist the idea that somehow is the real Islam or the central Islam.
Let me just be, we got to be more careful here. I am saying that it is unsurprising that a fairly large group of people can speak that way and convince others that they're right, right, given the actual doctrine. And it would be astonishing if they were working with a very different doctrine, right? If the Anglican Communion had a death cult within it run by a someone analogous to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was claiming that what Anglicanism is really about is, you know, the crucifixion of infidels and the beheading of apostates and, you know, homosexuals should be thrown off of rooftops, et cetera, et cetera. And that's really, and we've connected all the dots scrupulously, and this is what it is. That would be more surprising. I'll grant you not impossible, right, but, given but the history really, of Christianity, really, but really more surprising. Not impossible,
because I can think of a lot of verses that you could use from the Bible to justify homosexuals off rooftops, killing heretics.
That's true. Yeah. Hence the history of Christianity.
A lot of Leviticus is pretty peculiar.
That's quite true. You're speaking to the converted here. But the point is that all of these differences matter. I'm just saying all these differences matter, at least within the span of our life now, here in the 21st century. The differences matter.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. You know, I'm full of sympathy with you in saying that you cannot understand ISIS or Al-Qaeda without taking seriously the fact that they have religious beliefs. So I think one of the ways, that a loss of their horrifying behavior is driven by their particular forms of religious beliefs. I think that's completely right. And I don't think there's anything wrong with you emphasizing how horrible and evil those beliefs are. And I think the danger that I'm worried about is that I would be more comfortable if I heard you say, this is why I think Islamists are horrifying or why jihadists are evil and wrong, rather than using the phrase Islam or the word Islam.
Well, because I think the problem is wider. I mean, while I tend to focus on jihadists, I think I did in our first conversation, and then I can broaden my concerns to Islamists for certain purposes. But it's also, in fact, true that there are many, many millions, probably hundreds of millions, you know, maybe a billion, fairly conservative Muslims who certainly don't consider themselves jihadists. And I mean, they would probably despise jihadists, certainly of any group like Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And they don't consider themselves Islamists. I mean, they might not vote for the Islamist candidate in any local election, but they're nonetheless extremely conservative and even intolerant on specific issues around, let's say, women's rights, right? You know, like what do you do when your daughter gets, you know, is found holding the hand of a man she's not married to, right? They might have attitudes born of their religion that are still problematic for, you know, integration in a Western modern society, say. And it's worth talking about that. And so there's more to be worried about under the aegis of Islam, in my view, than just jihadism and Islamism. But I'll grant you it's certainly worth being most concerned about those two things. But it's not just the Islamic State. It's in your own society, Rory. It's in mine, but much more so in the UK than in the US at the moment. I mean, you know, I can talk to you about the attitudes of British Muslims that reveal the same problem. I mean, like, you know, 2 weeks after the 7/7 bombings in London, where I'll, you know, remind our listeners, you know, four suicide bombers killed, I think, 52 people and injured over 700. You know, there was a poll done 2 weeks after that, and, you know, 6% of British Muslims said that the bombings were fully justified, right? I mean, without caveat, right? Now, that at the time, that represented something like 100,000 people in the UK. So in 2005, you had something like 100,000 people who expressed unqualified support for a jihadist attack in your capital. And the problem persists until today. I mean, I know people who've been told by the Metropolitan Police in London, I know at least one public intellectual, I'm sure there are more, who's been told recently, like since the October 7th attacks in Israel, not to go to London because he can't be kept safe there, right? And if I were more famous in the UK, I would probably be one of those people. So it's again, this is the problem of your own colleague, Mike Freer, who I assume you know, who just resigned last week because of all the Islamist death threats he's getting in London. This is not happening. Mormons are not behaving this way. That's my point, and that's why a focus on Islam seems warranted.
So, Sam, I guess my view is that the world is an ugly, cruel place, and human nature is horrible, and religion is often a part of that. And I think our last conversation was a lot about trying to remind you of how strange and violent and bloodthirsty many people around the world are who are not Muslims, and how bizarre and irrational their views are. You talked about honor killing. There's an enormous amount of honor killing perpetrated by Hindus.
Yes, that's true.
You talk about rape and violence and murder, and what Buddhists in the Burmese army did, whipped up by Buddhist monks against Muslim communities in Rohingya, entailed all those things on the most horrendous scale. 6% of people supporting some crazy terrorist incident was much lower than I thought you were going to say.
Well,
I mean, I can point to communities in the United States. Yeah, but I can point to polling results in Britain and the United States, where our fellow citizens in huge numbers have the most unbelievably insane views about a whole series of things.
Yeah.
You know, goodness knows what percentage of our fellow citizens believe in UFOs. Goodness knows what number of them, you know, embrace the death penalty, think that migrants should be shipped out in shackles, or goodness knows what else they believe, right? So I think the thing that I'm trying to say and feel is you're absolutely right. I'm not in any way naive about this. I've lived in, you know, a lot of my life in Muslim majority countries. And I'm very, very aware that there were many people around me, including people I liked, frequently working class people who worked on projects with me or who I interacted with, who had shocking views about the world.
Okay,
but equally, equally, I also feel this in Russia, right? You know, I feel that 85% of people in Russia support the operations in Ukraine. 87% of Israelis believe there should be no ceasefire in Gaza. I mean, these are figures that just are beyond imagining to me. But what they reveal is humanity in its tribalism and its fanaticism, and Islam is part of a much bigger picture.
Okay, well, I was trying to interrupt you there just to point out that these friends of yours with odious beliefs, these are the Nazis who you could imagine not condemning as people, but for their terrible ideas, right? So this is just closing the loop on the claim you were making earlier that you can't imagine not judging the Nazis down to their toes because of their despicable beliefs. I can separate people from their beliefs because I can imagine arguing them out of them. These beliefs are not intrinsic characteristics. They're vulnerable to conversation, for what you will.
But I think if I think about those people honestly, I think I was wrong to say that they were my friends.
Given a sufficient commitment to those beliefs.
Yeah, I think that to allow somebody who's actually a friend of yours to have those kinds of beliefs would not be real friendship. I would be engaged in some form of patronizing attitude towards them if I allowed them to continue to. So I suppose I would say that it's very important for me to think also about friends of mine who are very sincere and devout Muslims who do not hold any of those beliefs and who I feel immense admiration for. And I think the same is true of friends of mine who are religious believers and in all traditions. I mean, I think maybe this is another difference we have. I have a, for some reason that maybe I can't quite articulate, I have a lot of sympathy and admiration for devout religious believers of all sorts, and frequently find that they're amongst my most reliable, honest, compassionate friends. And I think their religion is part of that.
Yeah, that may be. I wouldn't deny that. I mean, one can argue that it's not the best way to generate those qualities, but it is one way, right? So, I mean, I'm not going to dispute that some people go to sub-Saharan Africa to help in a famine because they think Jesus wants them to do it, and they want to spread the faith alongside their, you know, doling out food. But I would just argue that that's not the only way to go to Africa to help people. You could actually just recognize that you feel a compassionate response to alleviating human suffering for non-dogmatic reasons, and you can do it that way too. So I mean, there are many routes to good behavior, and some of them are, you know, more rational than others. But that I want to go back to something you said, which I think makes the terrain a little more confusing, right? Well, first of all, you said one thing about you think it's really just we're just here talking about human nature and bemoaning its capacity for evil, and it's really this is not about Islam versus any other religion. This is, you know, just people, by for whatever stated reason, often find themselves creating immense and unnecessary harm in the world. And that's just what apes like ourselves do. And then we talk about it, and it's, you know, our motives may or may not even track what we claim they are. But then it would be, again, it is just a fact that you can criticize every religion on earth at this moment and make fun of it and draw cartoons about it and stage Broadway plays to its disadvantage, right? I don't know if you ever saw The Book of Mormon, which was a huge hit in America some years ago. You can do that about any other religion, but if you do it about Islam, you will spend the rest of your life in hiding from theocrats and maniacs, right? And so if that has nothing to do with the faith itself, which on your account, it sounds like it has nothing or next to nothing to do with it, and it's just human nature, well, then you seem to be alleging that the Muslim community has more than its fair share of psychopaths and bullies and odious people, right? And I don't think that's true, and I don't think you think that's true, right? So either the ideas are doing some work or they're not. And I think the answer is obvious, but you seem to be continually resisting the obvious.
I think, of course, ideas do work. But I return to my basic idea that there isn't one Islam, there are many Islams.
Yeah.
And also that we're historically situated, that there would have been a period where Christianity would have gone after you tooth and nails if you had blasphemed and mocked and put on those kind of plays.
Yeah.
And it's a sense probably partially about the decline in that kind of faith in the West.
Well, it's two things.
Go on.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's two things. One, Christianity is historically ahead of Islam in its collision with modernity and science and secularism and capitalism and democracy and et cetera. So Christianity has been beaten into shape by secular society to a degree that Islam hasn't. And it had a couple of centuries to get moderated in that way. And so we see those effects. And then there is just the other fact that I pointed to earlier, which is that the Bible is a far more vast and vastly self-contradictory document. And you can render unto Caesar's those things that are Caesar's much more easily under that scripture than you can under Islam, which is a much, you know, the Quran is a much shorter, much less self-contradictory, though, you know, albeit still contradictory, document, which you can read in a weekend. I mean, it's much, much shorter than the Bible in its totality. And it's a much more unified message. And the example of Muhammad is quite different and quite, you know, one note. And so there are differences too. But yeah, I mean, there are historical contingencies that are real. And yes, the Christians of the 14th century are not my idea of good neighbors.
And I guess I'm, again, looking around the world at all the problems that we face in the world, I feel that this focus on Islam, which I think is very rooted in 9/11, and is very rooted in specific terrorist experiences, which have given birth to a huge amount of interest in Islamist ideology and jihadism, when I look around the world, I think is just one small part of the problem. I think it's been given a prominence for historical reasons, which is out of all proportion to the kind of significance or threat that it poses on a global scale. I am much more worried about Russia-Ukraine. I'm much more worried about China and its treatment, in fact, of its own Muslim indigenous population and its Tibetan population and its threats towards Taiwan. I'm more concerned about Myanmar. I'm more concerned about the slaughter amongst Christian communities in South Sudan. I'm more concerned about what's happening, again, amongst Christian communities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. So if what I'm interested in is global security, human rights, peace, actually the Muslim world is a problem, but on a global scale, I don't know, say 20-30% of the problem in the world, and yet it's getting 70-80% of the chat.
Well, I don't think so. And I think you and I would probably agree, you know, modulo a few fine points. I think we would probably agree about the how we would rank order the global threats. So yeah, I mean, I'm not saying Islam is at the top with respect to certainly the thing that's going to cause a, you know, if you ask yourself, how do we get into a nuclear war that produces a nuclear winter that ruins everything? Well, that's not, the story, at least at the moment, has virtually nothing to do with Islam and a hell of a lot to do with Russia or China or both. and the U.S. So yeah, I'll grant you all that. But again, you take a problem of the sort that I just pointed out in the U.K., right, where you have a British MP resigning over threats, right, to his life and to the life of his family from Islamists in your society. And I mean,
Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, I do. But let me just give you a few more details. I mean, the last poll I saw of British Muslim opinion suggested that something like 25% of British Muslims wanted to live under Sharia law. And, half think that 50%, it was 52%, think homosexuality should be illegal. And so, those are public sentiments that I think are fairly indigestible in a society like yours. And when I say, and the reason why this is not ancient history, or
what percentage of Republican Americans think homosexuality should be illegal?
I don't know, but I think it would be quite a bit lower than that. Yeah.
Still substantial. I'm sure it would be pretty substantial. And certainly in many, many European Catholic countries.
Yeah, I don't know. But then I think if we drill down on what they think the sanction for it should be, illegal how? What are the consequences?
And I'm sure that would be true with your poll as well. Did someone drill down? I mean, when people say they want to live under Sharia, I have many friends who say that to me. And then when you actually push them on that, they don't really mean what you think they mean.
Okay, that's the onus on the pollster and the respondent, yes. But obviously many do. I mean, I will, again, stipulate that polls have to be taken with a grain of salt.
Homosexuality was illegal in Britain until the 1960s.
Yeah.
The fact that there are conservative religious people living in our country, and there were many, many Catholics in my constituency who were horrified with me when I voted for gay marriage. The fact that there are conservative religious people, Muslim, Christian, and others, who continue to believe what the majority of people in Britain believed as recently as the 1960s, doesn't strike me as an existential threat to my society.
Okay, but again, this is just a few more fine points. The 25% who say they want to live under Sharia law, one has to imagine that many of them, if not most of them, I'll grant you, not all of them, understand what that means, and the sanction for homosexuality and apostasy and blasphemy, et cetera, is death, right? So it's not the same thing as 1959 Britain still thinking that, Alan Turing probably shouldn't have been treated fairly the way we now think based on his homosexuality, right?
So when did we last kill people for being homosexual in Britain? When did the government last execute people?
Yeah, this is a good pop quiz for me in America.
But Sam, are you aware that we did this? Late into the 19th century. I mean, this is not. I mean, I agree.
The 19th Look, century.
If you are saying that there are very conservative people in our society, and Muslims tend to be, I think, probably more active,
but murderously and conservative people in your society. That's the problem.
I think our society, when it was killing homosexuals for homosexual acts, mm-hmm. my friend Chris Bryant, who's Labour MP, is just
200 years ago. Yes,
just written a book about it. Was a murderous society. Yes. Okay. So there are people with these views, and I profoundly disagree with them. But your claim that this is an existential threat somehow to Britain, I know Britain much better than you, I'm afraid, Sam.
That remains to be demonstrated. But for the purposes of this conversation, you have to connect a few dots.
Okay. I was a working member of parliament in a constituency. I know. Muslim constituents, right? I mean, my job was trying to deal with Britain. Our rates of homicide are much, much lower than those in your country.
Yes, you have fewer guns. I'll grant you that.
And it is in many ways a much more functioning civil society, I'm afraid, in the United States. And you need to reconcile with this the fact that I agree there are people out there, and some of them are people who I imagine are friends of yours and who talk about this stuff all the time, who want to suggest that somehow Britain is facing some existential threat to its foundations because of the presence of conservative Muslims inside British society. I think Britain is in many ways in a much healthier state than many other societies that I can think of, including the United States.
With respect to this issue of Islamism?
No, with respect to the society as a whole.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably true, but not with respect to this variable, which is to say that I don't think
you're putting too much emphasis on this variable. That's what I'm trying to say. Is that the people who emphasize this variable, whether in geopolitics, which is what we were talking about a few minutes ago, or whether in relation to Britain itself, like to imply that this particular variable, which I grant is there, I mean, of course there are a lot of conservative Muslims out there with views that I profoundly disagree with and that are incompatible with a secular liberal society. The question is, how obsessed should we be with this? How much of a problem is this? And in my experience, it's much less of a problem than the people who talk about this all the time think.
Well, that's, I guess that could be a matter of taste, but it's a little hard to adjudicate that.
Okay, well, let's take Mike Freer.
Take Mike Freer. So, is he right in thinking that it's a problem, given that his career has been arrested by his perceived security needs?
It's absolutely correct to say that Mike Freer was under real threat, and he received enormous numbers of threats from people who seem to me to have been jihadists, and I have all sympathy with him for stepping down. It is also true that a lot of my Muslim colleagues have received horrendous threats and abuse, particularly Muslim women members of parliament, from people who wish to characterize and threaten them because of their religious beliefs. It's also true that Jo Cox, who I knew and joined parliament with me, was killed, and she was killed by a white supremacist, not by a Muslim at all. She was a serving member of parliament who was killed. So yes, Mike Freer was threatened by one group in society, and yes, many of my other colleagues have been threatened and in one case killed by other groups in society. But somehow you're not talking about those other groups.
Well, because I know, again, I've been around this track for a very long time, and I know where the threat is coming from. So I have said the most uncompromising critical things about Christians in my society, which is quite famous for having more than its fair share of fundamentalist Christians. Right? I have hammered Christianity. I've spoken at Christian colleges and debate and just vilified the core tenets of their faith, right? In public, you know, and standing in front of 1,000 people. And I know what that's like. I know what comes back at you when you do that, Sam, and what doesn't come back at you.
But Sam, why when you tell the story of Mike Freer, don't you set the context that I set? Why don't you talk about the fact that the person who was killed, Jo Cox, was killed by somebody who wasn't a Muslim? Why don't you talk about the threats that have been made against Muslim MPs? Why have you implied, I'm afraid, through the sole focus on this, the implication I believe the listeners would have got is that there's a real problem in Britain because a member of parliament has been driven out by threats by Muslims, and somehow this tells you something about Islam because you haven't set the context of all the other threats against MPs from people who aren't Muslims.
Well, if you're in public life, if you're in the government, there's no question there are threats that come from all sides. The reason why I brought up Mike Freer as an ironic fact is that it happened right around the time, maybe even the very day, you seem to be diminishing any concern about Islamism in your own society and talking to Hamza Yousaf, right? So it was just contemporaneous with that conversation that happened this week or last week. But yeah, I mean, there are many other things I could bring up about life in the UK, which puts the onus on Islam uniquely from my point of view. I mean, if you look at the grooming gangs scandals, right, in Rotherham or Rochdale, right, that, you know, we're talking about something like 1,000, more than 1,000 British girls getting raped over the course of a decade. And when those crimes get brought to police attention, they decline to investigate for fear of being branded Islamophobic, right? I mean, these are insane stories, which
That's a particularly insane story, and that's largely a story about concerns about racism. That's not actually much of a story about Islam at all. I mean, I think oddly, you did exactly what I was hoping you wouldn't do,
which is conflate
the issue of Islamophobia with the issue of anxieties about race in the Pakistani
community.
Aren't
the perpetrators virtually all Muslim immigrants?
But that's absolutely not central to that case. What was central to that case, as far as one can tell, and it's a very controversial case because it's now become clear that there were a lot of white men also involved in these grooming gangs. But that aside, the failure to investigate this particular group seems to have been connected to your earlier definition of Islamophobia, which is police anxieties about being accused of being
racist.
Exactly.
Well, that's the way Islamophobia works in most contexts.
I think that's going off the question of religion. These were not particularly devout people with any particular views connected with anything that we've been talking about in relation to Islamism or jihad. That's to do with a police force not doing its job because they didn't want to be accused of being racist. Okay. So I think that's a different issue.
It's not different in the sense that nothing really turns on this, but I would would add, this is one reason why a narrow focus on jihadism and even Islamism is not sufficient, because I think the attitude toward non-Muslim girls expressed in that community, I would argue, very likely has religious underpinnings, right? So that, like,
or racist underpinnings of a different sort. Sam, I mean, I think the thing that
my point is, there are no Mormon variants of this kind of thing in...
Were the Mormons not doing extraordinary kind of... I mean, sorry, maybe I'm being unfair to the Mormons, but I believe there are horrible stories.
There are horrible stories about Mormons.
Sex abuse.
They're just not as horrible and not as widespread.
From Christian communities.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I'm afraid.
I'm no friend of the Mormons either. I mean...
Horrible stuff. Yeah. But Sam, the thing is that it's so difficult to know quite...
So are you just arguing that I have this out of proportion, that none of my claims are wrong? It's just I should be worried about other things more?
I think what I would say is that I'm trying to find an analogy. Let me try two analogies to explain what makes me uncomfortable. If I was, let's say I was in some other country, and whenever I talked about Americans, I focused on a particular group of extreme Trump supporters. And I said a lot of things about them which were entirely factually correct, but that's all I spoke about. It would be understandable if an American listening to that would think, well, hold a second, Rory, I can't prove there's anything factually inaccurate what you said, but there's so many other aspects to the United States that you're not talking about, and you're giving the impression, rightly or wrongly, by focusing on these particular extreme cases, that somehow this is a more widespread problem and that there are more of these people than there actually are. Or to give another example, sometimes when I'm worried about what's happening with the Israeli attacks in Gaza, I can find myself focusing a lot on the statements of Smotrich and Ben-Gavir. I can find myself remembering conversations where people have said to me that actions in Hebron are justified because Abraham died there, or in Nablus because Joseph was born there. And then I have to remind myself that these voices are not representative. That you have to approach these communities and societies generally with affection and love and compassion and balance all the time and set context all the time. And I don't think you're doing this, Sam. I think the risk is that you're talking to people in Britain who, this is not against you, but some of these examples you're giving are from the playbook of people that I see on television in Britain who just talk about the stuff all the time. I've got a good friend who does this to me all the time. And I really love him. He's one of my best friends. But all he wants to do is sit and bring up examples.
How do you think he got that way?
Of Muslims doing bad things.
Okay, but is it an accident that he and I seem to share, at least for the purposes of this conversation, share the same derangement?
I don't think it's a derangement. I don't think it's a derangement. I think everything that you've, as you've said, everything that you've said is true. But let me talk about my friend, not about you, okay? My friend, I want to say to him, please, for goodness sake, drop it. Because you don't really know the Muslim communities well. You don't spend time with them. You're not deeply embedded in these communities. A lot of what you're picking up from the media. It's at a remove. It's whipped up by a particular group of people who have a very strong obsessive views about this, and it's becoming unbalanced. And I don't know why you keep returning to this. That's at least what I'd say about him. So maybe when I hear you, I hear him, and maybe I'm unfair in ascribing to you.
The truth is, I think you and I have a sincere difference of opinion on many of these points, and it's to some degree informed by a different life experience, but I think more importantly, it's informed by a different theory of mind around these various groups and just whether people believe what they say they believe, et cetera. What is entailed when somebody is claiming to believe something? Just how likely is that to link up to any future behavior? I mean, I think you and I just have different assumptions about all this, and one I think was just revealed in what you just said when you compared this to your kind of knee-jerk, what you seem to think is your kind of knee-jerk, uncharitable view of Israelis based on hearing Ben-Gavir or anyone else say extreme things. And then you take a further moment to realize, no, that's not representative of everybody, and it's there's diversity of opinion, et cetera, and the general population is probably much more moderate. But I think that's an example that illustrates exactly what I'm arguing here, which is I think it is in fact true to say that if you gave most Israelis, now 90, more than 90% of Israelis, complete power to do whatever they want in Gaza and in the West Bank, and in the Muslim world generally, you give them a button they could press, which could accomplish anything, right? What would they do with it? Would they kill all Muslims? Would they kill all Palestinians? Absolutely not, right? What you'd have, I think, if you know, most Israelis would just kill all active members of Hamas and, you know, change the minds of anyone whose mind could be changed to live in peace with them. And they're not aspiring genocidaires over there in Israel. Granted, you can find the occasional right-wing lunatic or ultra-Orthodox, Bible thumper, but generally speaking, their attitude would be quite tolerant, and they simply want to live in peace with neighbors who would be willing to live in peace with them. Conversely, if you ask what would most Palestinians do, there are many, many Palestinians, I'm sure, who would be just that tolerant and just that pluralistic and willing to live in the modern world. But vast numbers of them, perhaps even something like a majority, given the results of recent polls around October 7th, might in fact perpetrate a genocide, right? And certainly their leaders would. Certainly Hamas would.
I don't believe that's happening.
Okay, so we have a different theory of mind.
Not just different theory of mind. I know lots of Palestinians. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the West Bank.
Okay, but you...
And I think the idea that they are...
Well, let me just specify what I think so you can react to it. I don't want you to misunderstand me.
You use the phrase genocidaire. I mean, I don't think they're genocidal. I don't think they in any way...
You don't think Hamas is genocidal?
I think that Hamas certainly has genocidal tendencies, or bits of the leadership of Hamas, and certainly some of the people that crossed the borders and did those horrible atrocities had profoundly genocidal views.
If Hamas is analogous to the government of, is in fact the government of at least Gaza, right? If Hamas could do whatever it wants, I mean, here's the claim, as you've heard it before, and I've even said it before, which is, if the Palestinians would simply lay down their arms, there would be a two-state solution and everyone would live in peace. If the Israelis laid down their arms, there would be a genocide of the Jews. I believe that is true. Something to a first approximation, I believe that is true. Do you doubt that?
I'm afraid I do doubt that, Sam.
Even with the explicitly genocidal charter of Hamas and the events of October 7th?
Because I saw the explicit charters and statements of the Taliban, and then I saw the reality of what happened when they took over the country. We believed, on the basis of what they said, that they would perpetrate genocide against Takfiri Shia Muslims in Hazarajat. We believe that
you believe that because they used to be attempting to do that within their means, you know. So,
and since they've taken over, they haven't done that. And the reason they haven't done that is because even Islamists can often behave, not all of them. I mean, I think ISIS is in a completely different category.
Okay, so ISIS
Iranian Islamists, for example, and Iran is the sort of definitional Sharia theocracy, is not a state that conducts genocidal actions against religious minority groups. So, I don't want to be an apologist for Hamas, because they are a horrifying group that, given half a chance, would be at the very least flinging just as many rockets and shells and aerial bombardments and killing hundreds of thousands of Israelis given half a chance. So I think they are a murderous terrorist group, but I don't think that their objective is to do what Hitler did. No.
Okay, well, that's it. So we have a difference of opinion there. I don't know how we could adjudicate that, but giving them the access to as many Jews as they could kill. But, you know, it seems to be belied both by how they behaved on October 7th and how they aspired to behave based on their first charter. And, you know,
charters, Rod. I mean, remember that it depends which bits of charters you're looking at. But let's take the IRA in Britain. The IRA was effectively committed to driving the British out of Ireland. And they wanted an Irish state from coast to coast, from sea to sea. And they denied the existence of the British state. And they set off bombs in London that killed women and children. They blew up hotels. They committed astonishing atrocities. And in the end, Martin McGuinness and the Ulster Unionists came to, under Ian Paisley, came to a peace deal. And we have now had peace in Northern Ireland since 1997, 98. It's almost unimaginable if you look at their actions and the statements that they made. So do I think it's possible that Hamas could go through the same journey? I absolutely do. And I think that...
Would you say the same about the Islamic State?
No, I would not say the same about ISIS. I think ISIS is...
What would you? What do you attribute the difference to? And I guess maybe throw Al Qaeda in here too. Give me the gradations of weirdness and evil, and why are they different?
I think fundamental to ISIS is a very unusual and dangerous vision of an international caliphate, and a particular appearance to an extreme 7th-century view of Islam, including notions of slavery.
Yeah.
And the Hamas movement is instead an Islamist-inflected outgrowth of a Palestinian national movement.
And the Muslim Brotherhood.
Which is connected to a particular piece of territory, a particular combination between jihadism connected with a national liberation struggle. And that's different to the way in which ISIS operates.
Okay, well, let me fully agree with that, but just put it in my terms. I think ISIS is the scariest and truly incorrigible case because it is a pure expression of religious certainty, right? I mean, they're all about religion. And from the point of view of ISIS, members of Hamas are apostates or close enough to warrant killing, I can imagine, because they are focused on these terrestrial goals like building nations. And, it's just not, they're not purpose toward the global caliphate, which is really the only appropriate religious goal. So I agree with you that they're quite a bit further gone than members of Hamas are likely to be. I just happen to think that Hamas has crossed over into something more jihadist than I thought was true of them, even when I knew of their charter, years ago. I just think October 7th puts the burden of doubt on anyone who would say that they're
October the 7th was beyond horrifying. And it's also true to say that it surprised an enormous number of people, including deep scholars of Islam and experts on Islamic terrorism. So I was talking to somebody who you would know well, who was himself came from a jihadi background, who was saying to me that he was astonished to discover the way that Hamas behaved on that day, because it simply wasn't consistent with their tenets or views, which creates endless debates now within the system about whether this was deliberate Hamas policy, whether other groups crossed with them. And we are not in any position to resolve that. But you're absolutely right in saying that particularly the rape, the deliberate murder of civilians, the atrocities went so far beyond what people believed was the traditional Hamas approach that people are still struggling to work out whether Hamas had fundamentally changed, whether people hadn't understood them in the first place, or whether they lost control over groups that were doing things that the leadership hadn't intended.
Yeah. And I would grant you that the opposite surprise is conceivable in their case. It's like if you said, 20 years from now, things have moved on and Hamas is suddenly still exists and is suddenly behaving a little bit more like the Taliban is now behaving. They used to be total maniacs, as witnessed on October 7th, but now they seem to be capable of more moderation for whatever pragmatic or cynical or even noble reasons, right? I would admit that kind of change is conceivable in them, but in the present, I think it is appropriate to take them at their word, which is they would do October 7th again and again and again. They intend to do it again and again and again if only given the chance, and they should be dealt with on that basis. I mean, that's my view of what is true now.
But then again, Sam, we also need to get into the much more difficult question of what does dealing with them mean? Because that's where things become very strange, because it may well be the case that they pose a very profound and dangerous threat to Israel. But it may also be the case that the military operations being conducted are not likely to achieve the objectives of dismantling Hamas. That in fact, it's much more likely to drive more people into supporting them and doing so at an astonishing cost to civilian lives.
Well, here's the military operation I would recommend to resolve our debate here and usher in world peace. And I say this tongue-in-cheek for reasons that'll be obvious. But and perhaps I brought this up last time when we were speaking about this, but I mean, this for me differentiates what is unique at this moment, you know, if only in this century, but I would argue for several centuries running, perhaps even for a millennium, is different about Islam from other religions, which is, if what if Israel said this? Okay, we agree that our bombing of Gaza was all too much, and we're just sick of killing your kids. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque unless you return the hostages tomorrow, right? It's just a building. We're not going to kill any Palestinians. These are just bricks and, you know, bad gold leaf. We don't much like this building. You guys seem to like it, but we're going to blow it up at noon tomorrow unless you return the hostages. What do you imagine would happen? Of course, I mean, this is a rhetorical question. We know all hell would break loose in 100 countries. And for purely religious reasons, for purely delusional reasons, for reasons that would get scores of people killed and might even, you know, erupt in World War III. I don't mean scores of people killed. I mean scores of thousands of people killed, you know, on the first day. And all of this is religion. All of this is religious, an attachment to religious symbols, right? And again, I would argue that there's only one religion functioning this way. Well, and when you look at the...
Look what's just happened with the violence and killing that in Gujarat and around Ayodhya in relation to the imagined demolition of a Hindu temple. And its replacement by
well, we can talk about India. I mean, I would love in another hour. I would love to talk with you about India.
But again, the entire Crusades was predicated on the capture of Jerusalem.
But also 1,000 years ago.
We're refighting this. If you're saying, would it be the most unbelievably reckless, offensive, violence-provoking act imaginable to destroy the Dome on the Rock?
But isn't it interesting?
I absolutely agree with you.
But just to threaten
and equally to threaten to destroy the Ayodhya Mosque that's been built over the Babri Masjid would be something that would bring hundreds of millions of Hindus up in arms.
Yeah, but that's just to say that Hindu nationalism has gotten quite a bit crazier than anyone would want of late. And insofar as it has begun to resemble the Muslim agitation over religious symbols, then I think it's all to the bad, no doubt. But my point is, it's just a building. And the fact that destroying it or burning a Quran or drawing the wrong cartoons or doing anything like that is so inflammatory that you have a community that is so combustible, not just in the Middle East, but, you know, the world over, I mean, in something like 100 countries. The reason why it's a global concern for me, again, I'll grant you, it is not the thing that's going to provoke thermonuclear war anytime soon, but it is on the list of global concerns. It is the thing that I notice more than any other thing touching the norms of open societies. Our society is not living under the pressure of how dangerous it is to criticize Russia.
I don't feel my society is living under pressure. I don't feel open society in Britain is threatened in any way at all, Sam.
When 400,000 people come out after October 7th in the streets of London,
including an enormous number of my non-Muslim friends.
Okay, but yes,
enormous number of my non-Muslim friends were on that march.
I don't doubt that, but that what percentage of people in that march do you think? Again, these are hard questions to answer because you would just be guessing. But what you're presuming is informative of everything you think. What percentage of people in that crowd do you think understood exactly what happened on October 7th? Right, which is to say, they weren't taken in by conspiracy theories about nobody was raped and, you know, there were no non-combatants killed. Right, there are those people too, but what percentage of people actually knew what happened, the intentional killing of non-combatants in the most horrendous ways, and the stealing of children and old women as hostages, what percentage understood what happened and condoned it and are essentially taking the Hamas side of that dispute?
I don't know. And
it's vanishingly small, or you think it's a majority?
I don't know. I would guess maybe 10, 20%. I mean, I'm guessing, but my guess is that people with those kind of extremely unpleasant views are morally poorly developed, haven't thought properly, are lacking in empathy. And if you sat them down and actually made them confront the reality of what happened, might well have different views. I think there are lots of crazy things that crowds feel. I think there are a lot of profound prejudices that exist in all our populations, and I don't think Muslims are unique in this. And I think there are some astonishing views that you would find amongst white Americans, which again, will be to do with ignorance, will be to do with prejudice, will be to do with lack of understanding often. But I do not feel that the open society in Britain is remotely under threat. I think this is a hysterical fantasy of people who have become unnaturally obsessed.
How hysterical
with Islam?
Okay, but how hysterical
what do you
is
mean
it?
The open? What do you mean the open society is under threat? Under threat in Britain?
I'll tell you exactly what I mean. I mean, I've said it before in this conversation, but I literally have a friend who is a well-known public intellectual who very much like me makes points of the sort I have made in this very conversation, but in a way that is no more redolent of bigotry than I am, right? Like than I have been.
Sam, you're on the very gentle end of this. By the time you're into Douglas Murray and people, you're getting into different territory.
Okay, but that's interesting. Why do you think that, what's the difference between me and Douglas Murray on this point?
Because I can...
Do you know Douglas personally, by the way?
Yeah, I do. I do. Okay. I do. I've debated with him. I debated with him on the Iraq War. I've seen him on stuff. I've seen his political positions. I've seen statements that he's made in overseas. I think he is considerably more provocative and inflammatory than you are on these issues.
Well, he's more... I'll grant you that... So, I can't sign off on everything Douglas has said about everything because I'm just unaware of it, but he's more provocative in the sense that he touches this issue. This issue represents a much greater percentage of the topics he touches than it does for me, right? I mean,
obviously I profoundly disagree with him. I think he is completely exaggerating the threat that Islam poses to our society, and in a way that I think is dangerous and encourages hatred of Muslims.
Okay, well, so I think in this conversation, for the purposes of this conversation, there is very little daylight between me and Douglas, or at least what I understand Douglas to have said on this issue in the past. Again, there could be something that I'm unaware of. And I would just say that it is a problem that your society is under threat.
It's not under threat.
If someone like Douglas can't stage a public event safely or can't walk the streets safely in London, that's the kind of thing I would say is a direct threat to an open society. And you wouldn't.
How to respond to that. I think it's very, very awful, the threats that Islamists have posed to people, the threats they posed to Salman Rushdie, the attack that was mounted against Salman Rushdie, I think, in your own country.
Yeah.
I think that religious violence of all sorts and terrorism of all sorts is horrifying. And I think it is always horrifying in a society if the police feel they are unable to protect prominent public intellectuals from attack. Do I think that British society in general is facing some existential threat? Absolutely not. It is one of the safest, most prosperous, educated societies on earth. It's considerably better off than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. And this, in all the problems that we face in the world and all the societies that we should be worried about in the world, this is, I'm afraid, in the grand scheme of things, being talked out of all proportion. There are much more profound problems to our society than this.
Well, let me just make one related point just to clarify any confusion that you might have or that our listeners might have about what I would hope for British society or any other on the topic of immigration, because I think it would be fair to draw the conclusion based on everything I've said so far that I wouldn't be in favor of more Muslim immigration to Britain or anywhere else I care about as an open society. And that's not true. In fact, I would say that there'd be no one more valuable to add to your society or to mine than genuinely moderate, secular, liberal Muslims.
And
Let me just finish before your incredulity gets the better of both of us. And I would add to that, the absolute top of that stack would be ex-Muslims, right? People who come from Pakistan or, you know, any majority Muslim country with all the wealth of experience that entails and all of the cultural diversity they would be offering, including their absolute knowledge of all the gradations of belief under Islam, and for them to be on the totally rational, secular, and even atheistic ultimately side of it, those people are my favorite people to bring those people to the front of the line before the Christians, before anyone else, right? But I want Sam, them in my society, and I want them living next to me.
But right? Sam, this is absurd, because you've just spent most of this thing saying that most Muslims are not like that.
But many are not. Not most, but the point is we need to keep jihadists and Islamists out of our societies at this point, insofar as that's possible. I'll grant you that that's difficult, but we don't want more incorrigible jihadists. We don't want more.
I'm 100% with you. Okay. I couldn't agree with you more. We are in violent agreement on that.
Great.
Violent agreement on that. And there are many other.
How would you do that?
Many other things we don't want in our society.
But what do you think Douglas wants?
We don't want organized crime. We don't want crazy criminal gangs.
Don't go rape.
We don't want. I mean, there are many threats to our society.
Do you think Douglas would disagree with that? Do you realize that Douglas has very, very close friends who are ex-Muslims and moderate Muslims, right? And that he's not, that I think he's no more guilty of bigotry than I think I am. And you would agree with him and me that you don't want more jihadists and Islamists in your society. So what extremity has Douglas, meandered off into that you find so reprehensible?
I think I'm sure I'm being unfair by pulling Douglas in because he's not here to defend himself. And I can see we're going to be pulled into a third podcast with the appearance of Douglas as well. So in order to avoid I will renounce my attempts to engage with what Douglas does or doesn't believe.
Okay.
I think just to return, because I'm worried that, we're all in danger of repeating ourselves now, that there is a tendency within Britain to focus so much on the focus of Islam, on the concept of Islam and the threat posed by Islam, and to exaggerate it, to my mind, out of all proportion, in order to create a hysterical sense that Britain is facing some existential crisis, and by doing so, casts a difficult light or shade on Muslims in Britain, and distracts from the fact that in many ways ours is a very, very healthy functioning society, that the problems we're facing are not profound, and that most of the problems in Britain and internationally have very little to do with this issue.
Okay, well, I think we probably should leave it there. I mean, this is, I think, unless you think you could land a blow or two
Can't land any edifying blows.
Okay.
Sam, thank you. Can I return by apologizing? I think you've approached this with very, very, a lot of patience and precision and good heart. I sense, I don't know you well. I mean, and these are very odd things. And I do want to bring this to, because I do podcasts too, to the viewer's attention, how bizarre and artificial these encounters are. I'm sitting in a very nice man's room about 4.5 miles outside New Haven, Connecticut, in a funny side street, looking at a bunch of guitars on the wall with the sun setting outside, trying to get to a music concert, which I'm late for, with my mother-in-law. And meanwhile, we're conducting this conversation as though we were somehow across the table from each other in a university seminar room. But thank you. And I think you've given me things to think about. And I think you're also right in saying that in the end, we disagree, but at least we're disagreeing agreeably.
Indeed. And it was fun. And thank you for your time, Rory. Thank you for your patience and your willingness to do this. And hopefully people will find it useful. I think they probably have.
Thank you, Sam.